because you're in the subsurface and there's geological laying, they take the image to be, it's a choice of discretization, to be finely discretized vertically and relatively smooth horizontally. And that, of course, will show up in the kind of things which we're doing. Very first thing they do is a travel time tomography. So they'll pick first arrivals, use travel time tomography to get an estimate of the velocity field, and then use that to do either a migration or some other kind of imaging related to that. Now, the stuff I've been working on with John is related to the travel time tomography, and it's specifically related to some problems that he was having with head waves. Now, you can imagine in this situation, head waves are waves, they're like, depending on what you've seen before, they're like Rayleigh waves on the surface. They're surface waves, but they travel along high velocity regions. So you can have a signal in one well and receiver in another well, but a high velocity region. And a head wave would be, as you try to solve the travel time problem, the energy looks like it's going to go very quickly down to the fast velocity range, move very much along the fast velocity layer, and then come back down. Okay, so here's a picture of the kind of thing that we were trying to address. Okay, this is my next to the last slide. I'll just go straight to the example, right? Okay, so here's the layering, so you can sort of see the kind of situation. You know, going from 2,400 to 3,000 feet in this situation. And there are various, you can very, very thin layering. We did this as a synthetic test, so we ran a finite difference model through here where the source is here and the receivers are all along here. And because the source is on this side, we made time actually go this way. This is the data which you gather. And so you can see for this source, at each particular location, you can see a trace. And you can see there's quite a bit of energy coming all the way through here. But when you do the ray tracing, I'll say a minute about how we do that when we get in there. When you do the ray tracing, you see the rays come up and just zoom across the fast velocity layers. Okay. Now, this doesn't look very nice because if you're going to use this ray tracing, you're going to have a velocity where the velocity is the solution for a tomography problem where those are the rays. Okay, and we've seen already a picture this afternoon of rays which look like that. Well, we don't like that because you're probably not going to get a very good interpolation between these. But more than that, that's actually not physically what you're seeing here. It just doesn't look very physical. And the problem is, of course, this is a high-frequency approximation. Okay, and so we'll get into further ideas related to that, but I at least wanted to show you the picture. And when you do this, and you actually pick the arrival times, I didn't have a color Xerox available, but this line along here, this dark black line, is the actual travel times which you would pick as first arrivals. So they have some very good people, very experienced at picking the first arrivals. This dashed line is what this ray tracing algorithm estimates as being the first arrivals. Remembering that time is going this way, you can see that these arrivals are coming in substantially earlier than actually energy is coming in. Okay. Now, if we all live in a theoretical world where we believe high-frequency approximation, we're doing the right travel time calculation here. But when we pick data from real data, when we pick travel times from real data, it's not so good. Okay. So the goal was to, well, should we get rid of head waves? How can we handle this problem? And so this is what we did. So we came up with, shall we say, partially mathematically ad hoc, but on the other hand, very effective and has been very useful in their tomography code. Okay. So we came up with this idea, which we call wave tracing. The idea is there are relatively many ways of handling what are called fat rays using various other approximations other than just geometric optics, high-frequency approximations. Okay. And what we wanted was we wanted something which could use the current structure of their code, which did not involve going away from rays. So essentially what we want is find the rays along which band-limited signals travel. Well, good luck. There's no such theory. Okay, you know, and you could possibly do some kind of asymptotic expansion, which would say for relatively large but not infinite frequency waves, we didn't go there. Okay. So we're building that on ray bending. Now, ray bending is one of the several different ways you can compute travel times. Okay, what we saw earlier this afternoon was sort of shooting. That would be you want to find a travel time from some source to maybe a bunch of receivers. You just shoot out the rays. You solve do an initial value problem, then essentially have to do what's called, obviously, a shooting method, and then you try to home in the initial angle on where you would actually hit the values. Now you can see that there might be some problems with shooting. Okay, so from here, all of the things which are going to these points down here are coming from an infinitesimal small range of angles. Okay, so in problems like this, especially with the layering, and that of course has to do with their particular applications, they've tended to use ray bending. Ray bending is you solve a two-point boundary value problem by going to the variational formulation. So instead of actually using the differential equation formulation, you have the variational formulation. So then you just set up a discretization for the ray and you try to minimize travel time. Okay? And now if you're lucky and you have a good discretization and you solve to convergence, then you actually get a ray which satisfies Snell's law, and then it does satisfy Snell's law in the discrete problem, and then it will satisfy the Eichel differential equation. Or you can do other kinds of things, these fast marching methods and so on, Eichel solvers, and I won't go into those. Okay? So we're going to base this on ray bending because that's what they use. And the main concept is the concept of a Fresnel zone, and that has to do with basically the kind of indeterminacies in the travel time picks, which we'll get into. I'll show you the example, which I've already shown you, and then make a couple of comments. Okay. So, what do we want these travel times for? They're needed in seismic imaging techniques, all kinds of things, including travel time tomography. And we're using the tomography to get us an initial velocity model, plus a bunch of other things used in their imaging techniques. Usually based on high-frequency approximations, and if you solve those, they'll lead to Snell's law. The high-frequency ray paths minimize travel time, but they're not the paths along which most of the energy travels, okay? Especially if you have fast velocity regions. Okay. So what are we going to do? We'll make an extension of ray bending. We're going to have that be connected to a characteristic frequency. So we basically are trying to get some kind of a replacement for ray tracing so that we can figure out what the paths along which band-limited signals will travel. And our key to that will be we'll get the ray paths to stay in what's called this first Fresnel zone. Again, we'll get there in a minute. This will end up shortening the ray paths. It'll end up giving a more consistent coverage of the ray paths. And then you say, hold on, aren't you just cheating? You know, the ray paths are what they are. Well, the ray paths are infinite frequency. They have a false assumption in them. Okay, so if we can get something that stays within the Fresnel zone, then that's going to be the way that we'll maintain the physics, but we'll end up with a much better ray coverage, therefore a much better tomography problem, and the proof is in the pudding. Does it actually match the measured travel times that are picked from data? And you can guess what the answer is going to be. It's going to be more consistent with the paths and times for band-limited signals. Okay. If you want to just have a vision of this, suppose you have a very thin layer with high velocity, slow on top, okay? And you take a very low frequency wave, okay, which has a spatial wavelength that's pretty long, and you sort of think of kind of a spherical thing of this moving out. Well, this spherical thing isn't going to come along and all of a sudden zoom along in this layer and then come back out. Well, you know what it's going to do. It'll see that layer, but it'll pretty much kind of move through it in a more direct path. Okay. Now, I don't have long, careful microlocal analysis to justify that because there's no place about which to really do an asymptotic expansion. Okay, but these are the ideas we wanted to come up with. And so here's the rays for Snell's law, and these are the kind of rays we get out of our wave tracing. You can still definitely see the fast velocity regions, but you're going to get a much wider range of coverage, better range of aperture, and this looks a little bit more consistent with the seismic data that I showed you. Okay. So, without going into all the details of every possibility of the model and whatever, I'm just going to give you an example of how this idea works. Consider a 3D model with a flat parallel planar interfaces. They may be parts of structure and subsurface, so they don't have to necessarily be zero dip. We'll assume that has constant slowness in each layer. Just makes the formulas I'm going to show you much easier to convince you of things. The segments of rays in each layer are then going to be straight lines, because if we're minimizing travel time, if we have the intersection points here and it's constant slowness, then there'll be straight segments in each layer. Travel paths will stay in a plane if we have one fixed source at the point x0, z0, and a receiver at xn plus 1, zn plus 1. And we'll do a coordinate transformation to zero-dip geometry. So if these are actually going like this, we'll just switch this around that. We'll forget about the fact that the wells are actually going like this, because we're just looking at these two points. And this, then, is the generic picture we want to look at. So we have layers here. Within each layer, we have a segment. And there are, of course, many other possible difficulties one could deal with in terms of turning rays, but that's the geometry that I want to use to explain our idea. So we have a source point at x0, z0. We have a receiver point at xn plus 1, zn plus 1. We're not going to consider turning paths where something could go down to a fast layer below, zoom across, and come back up. Now we want to describe our idea. So for convenience, I'm going to let ci be the x increments, the zeta i's be the z increments, and ri be the length of the ith segment. So that's the part of the segment in the ith layer. Okay, so let's look at what would standard ray bending travel time tomography be if we're going to set this up as a minimization problem. Let wi be the constant slowness in the ith layer. That's 1 over the wave speed. So slowness times length is going to give you time. The travel time along this path is then just going to be the sum of the travel times along the individual segments. That's the sum of slowness times length in each segment. So standard ray bending minimizes this travel time. So what we're going to do is we want to straighten the path in some fashion. So the modified objective function will minimize, will take the travel time, and this, of course, was coming out of the computer code, so we'll have a normalization factor in here. But we're going to then add a term here. It's a penalty term, which penalizes length in some fashion. Okay, so the first idea we came up with is, of course, well, let's just try to make it the shortest possible ray, which satisfies a certain condition with respect to the Fresnel zone. Okay, and that wasn't as successful. So we came up eventually with looking at this formulation. So it's going to be some LP, where P equals M, norm of these ray segments normalized by some length constant to get parameters to make sense. So M is a fixed power. These are normalizing constants. And the key thing is going to end up being the penalty weight, because how we choose the penalty weight will have the connection with frequency. Okay. So I don't have physics to justify this, but I do have, when you use this, you end up with better images. You also end up with more accurate travel times compared with the actual travel times you get when you pick them. So what happens if m equals 1? If m equals 1, then we're just saying we're going to have a balance between minimizing travel time and a sum of the lengths of the segments. Okay, so balancing travel time with the length of the entire ray. But if you look at that, the sum of the lengths of the segments we're inside here is just wi times ri. You can factor out the ri, and that's the same as just changing the slowness. Okay, so what are we doing here? Well, instead of having slowness as wi, we'll have slowness as wi plus alpha times t0 over r0, and we're doing standard ray bending. Okay? So that didn't seem to be very nice. I mean, that's a nice idea. You can just say, go ahead and do your travel time tomography. Use the wrong slowness, and that's going to make things look nicer, and then we didn't care for that so much. When m equals 2, the penalty term represents more of a variance. That's speaking very loosely, a variance of the lengths of the ray segments. Okay, and that's what we've been using. And that turns out, when you examine it, you can prove a number of interesting things about that. So here's our modified objective function, f of x with this parameter alpha. It's this weighting on the penalty term, travel time plus alpha times r of x. I've normalized t0 and r0 to be 1, and r of x is just this sum of squares of these lengths. Now, some of this has to do with their particular formulation. Okay? Their particular formulation, their layers are pretty evenly spaced. Okay? I wouldn't write the formulation in this fashion if you had one layer that was thick and the next layer thin, because then you're insisting on a particular relationship. Take the gradient, figure out what that is. Okay, but if your layers are evenly spaced, then this is a reasonable thing to do. Otherwise, you'd need a weighting factor in each layer. Okay, so you can see there would be many details to get this set up correctly, but I think I've chosen enough here so you can get an idea of how it works. What happens when you do standard ray bending? Well, we minimize travel time, take the gradient with respect to xi, and you see the derivative with respect to xi, that means as we move xi, well, because this zi as it's set up is a function of xi, or the zi is fixed, this point is determined by the xi. So those are the only independent variables from 1 to n, x0 and xn plus 1, those are in the wells, those fixed. Okay. So what is the condition for the gradient of t to be 0? Well, when you write it out and take the c's and so forth and you identify the signs, you get Snell's law. Okay. So, and you can prove there's a unique minimizer, and that unique minimizer satisfies Snell's law. Obviously, if it's in the interior of the model, the gradient has to be 0. Okay, now, what does wave tracing do? Well, same thing. Start with a punchline here. There's a unique minimizer, one for each alpha. Okay? And when you take the gradient, you end up with something which looks a lot like Snell's law, but instead of having just this term, we now have a term with the alphas in it. Okay. Now, the interesting thing is, when you cover this up, sine theta is a function which ranges only from 0 to 1. Okay? But if we look at this function here, for any positive wi and zeta I, when theta goes from 0 to pi over 2, this thing goes from 0 to infinity, which means that there's no critical angle. Okay? You give me a number on this side, then I can find you an angle on this side, which will match it. Okay. So one of the problems, which is where the head waves are coming from, is that you have a critical angle. If you come in at any angle beyond that, it's going to go along there. Well, here there is no critical angle. It's still going to have a Snell's law look to it. It still is going to move faster, move more in the fast layers, but it's kind of softened. Okay. So that gives you some idea of how to expect it to work. Now, let me say this: what this stuff about the Fresnel zone is. I know half of you have some physics in your background and know much more about Fresnel zones than I do. And if you're mathematicians, maybe you haven't seen these ideas in this particular fashion. Let me give you the idea. Seismic energy propagates not just along the ray path, but also within some kind of a zone around the Snell's law ray path. Okay, I think we all accept that, but in geophysics, they've really tried very much to spend time quantifying that. It's not uncommon for a small amount of energy to travel along the Snell's law ray path. Much more direct energy on these paths, which are more direct from source to receiver, but that energy arrives at a later time than energy traveling along the Snell's law ray path. Okay. Now, for a band-limited signal with most of its energy near some finite frequency f, in Hertz, all energy arriving at the receiver with no more delay than half a period from the energy traveling along the Snell's law ray path will influence what appears to be the first arrival. So this is sort of our physics statement. It's saying that if you have a frequency in your signal and you're picking a travel time, well, you're picking some kind of initial startup. Well, the frequency, if you're anything less than half a period away, how do you know? You know, it's just that part of the information that's kind of lost by having a band-limited signal. Now, most of the stuff which is done in geophysics using a Fresnel zone immediately goes to a spatial radius. Okay? We didn't want to do that here because we have spatial radius varies very differently when you have different velocities. So we'll stay with the time. Okay? So the zone in which this energy travels is called the first Fresnel zone. And why is it one-half? Well, that you could have a second Fresnel zone at twice the region and so forth with more probability that it's going to be in here than it is in the second Fresnel zone. We'll just take the first Fresnel zone. Okay, so what are we going to do? We want to get a ray which stays within the first Fresnel zone. We'll basically say, quote Jamie Rector from Berkeley, who worked with John. If it's within the Fresnel zone, you can't tell the difference from the data. So if you're doing travel time tomography and you're picking things, it's within the Fresnel zone. How do you know? The frequency of the data doesn't let you distinguish. So we'll be looking at this Fresnel zone. Let's get a little bit of background on it. If you have any path joining two points C and D, even if that path is not array, so it isn't a minimizer of anything, then the time for a signal to travel along that path, if it ever wanted to, would be just the line integral with respect to length, arc length, of slowness. For the path which minimizes travel time from C to D, then there's no longer a dependence on path because there's a minimizing path, and then you just have a function of C and D. That's the minimizing travel time. The Fresnel zone for a point source at A, so if you have a signal starting at A and a receiver at B, it's defined as a set of all points F for which, if you take the minimum travel time from A to F and add to it the minimum travel time from F to B, okay, then that is less than or equal to, I'm switching signs here, the minimum travel time from A to B plus 1 over 2F. Okay. Now, you can easily show that this sum is always non-negative, and so it's only when point F is close enough to this ray that the travel times associated with F, if you pass through F going from A to B, that travel time is no more than 1 over 2F times the minimum travel time, then we'll say that point's in the Fresnel zone. Okay. So what we want to do with wave tracing is find a ray which stays in the Fresnel zone, which in some sense gives us a better distribution of rays and is shorter. So here's the key observation. If you have any path, and the travel time along that path from A to B minus the minimum travel time is no bigger than 1 over 2F, then the entire path lies in the Fresnel zone. Okay. Very simple, just triangle inequality kinds of games here. So this is the thing we'll key on. We'll only take paths which have travel times a little bit longer than the Snell's law travel time, and that little bit longer is 1 over 2F. Now, why m equals 2? The reason for m equals 2 is now we can just sort of pull an entire chapter out of trust region theory from optimization to say we can make a connection between alpha and the frequency in a very simple fashion. Okay. So let's suppose now we're going to find the ray path that minimizes this variance of the lengths subject to the constraints. We're playing this duality game. Instead of minimizing travel time, we're going to minimize the length subject to the constraint that the travel time can be no bigger than 1 over 2f plus the Snell's law travel time. Okay, that's going to give us that something that's still going to stay in the Fresnel zone. But by Fermat's principle, if we look at this inequality constraint, okay, at this point, we have a stationary value of travel time, which means that locally, in the appropriate coordinate system, that this function here is going to be looking like a positive definite quadratic function. Okay? So if we approximate this function by a positive definite quadratic function, we end up with a positive definite minimization problem with a typical trust region constraint. Okay? And then that there's a lot of theory in this. That's equivalent to an unconstrained quadratic minimization problem with a penalty term, which is what wave tracing is. So, modulo the fact there's an approximation here. This is nonlinear or non-quadratic, but we've had no difficulties with that. So, what's left, we have to find the relationship between the penalty weight, which is alpha, and the trust region radius, here, square root of 1 over 2f. That relationship is monotonic, so if you increase alpha, okay, that means you're getting the rays straighter, then you're actually decreasing the frequency, which means this particular trust region is going up. Okay. So we want this. We know that our signals are somewhere between 750 and 1 hertz and then 1 kilohertz. Find the appropriate weight. Unfortunately, that's not the one you can do. What you can do computationally is, you give me the weight, I'll put it into my code, and I'll tell you what the trust region was, because in the end, I'll just take the difference between the travel time I got and the Snell's Law travel time. Okay. So this is the one we can do, and this part is the part I didn't even bother to show you. You can make some rough approximations to alpha as a function of f, and thereby approximate f as a function of alpha. Okay, so that's the kind of things which you want to do. And so what does it do? I should show, where's the old guy first? Okay, so here's Snell. In particular, see what the rays look like, but in particular, look at this gap between the predicted first arrivals and the actual picked first arrivals. Here's wave tracing with the frequency being the same as the frequency in the signal that was used to generate the synthetic solution of the wave equation, which we picked over here. And you can see it's right on top of it here. There's some problems near zero offset, as we always expect. In fact, in Crosswell, we very generally don't use travel times too close because of the problems with head waves. But away from the zero offset problems, we have that thing just flying right on top. What does this have to do with inverse problems? Well, in theory, part of the difficulty we have to do in solving inverse problems is making sure that the way we solve the problem and the way we're dealing with our forward problem is consistent with the actual data we're dealing with. Sometimes we just jump right into the inverse. This thing has probably had more influence on their tomography code than any of the other things we've been dealing with. So in summary, what have we been able to do? We have a modification of ray bending based on Fermat's principle. We minimize the sum of travel time along the path and a penalty term related to the length of the path. As the weight and the length penalties increase, the ray path gets shorter, travel time increases. We adjust the penalty weight to keep the ray path within Fresnel zone, within the first Fresnel zone for this characteristic frequency. We obtain more direct ray paths than Snell's Law ray path. They're closer to the path along which energy travels in band-limited signals. Surprising, every so often something nice happens in life. It's easier to compute these than the Snell's Law of Ray, because this is actually a regularized optimization problem. Okay, so not only does it give us better results, but it's actually quite a bit faster, and it leads to better behaved tomography algorithms as well. All right, made it to four, so thank you.
Sure, we have time for questions. Maybe I'll ask one.
Yeah.
I guess the poor man's way of addressing this that I've seen many times is to smooth the velocity model with a smoother of a characteristic wave length.
Yeah.
Did you compare that?
We didn't, because their particular models are it has to do with the way they actually discretize things. It's very important that they have very thin layers available, because they have well logs. And they actually know something about the variability in the well logs. And in their direct arrival travel time, we have ways of trying to get vertical structure down to that kind of level. Okay, so if we start doing this kind of thing by smoothing stuff out, then we lose part of the thing which they're actually able to deal with. It's a strange tomography problem, because unlike surface reflection tomography, where a lot of the variability is in the direction you're integrating, and thus you don't expect to get it, and so smoothing the velocity vertically isn't so bad. Here in the Crosswell problem, it's actually better set up. Okay? The region where you have very fine sampling is where you have very fine variability. And the region along which you can't get very much from a tomography problem because you're doing your line integrals almost horizontally, that's the region where you generally tend to have layers, and so it's smooth in that direction. Okay? So we don't really want to give up on this high vertical variability as a way of doing things. And in the end, there has more things to do with the way this connects with the way they do migration and imaging, which makes this a very nice way of getting up trajectories and so forth, which are needed for that. So, but that's something we haven't actually taken it and compared with it, because this has worked very well with their particular setup. So, yeah, thanks. Okay, good, thanks.
Well,